Hello and welcome to another eerie episode of Saved by the 90s. My name's Adam Patterson. With me today is a guy who would never leave Jersey for Indiana, Ken Bakley. Hey, Ken.
Hello.
The funny thing was I wrote that before we had a brief conversation before the show where you might be leaving Jersey. So
yeah.
Indiana, though.
No. When I was younger, apparently my dad tells the story. I was too young to remember this, where he was considering a move from the company he was working for at the time that would have taken our family to somewhere in rural Indiana. And
whoa.
So I did think about that while watching the show, and it didn't happen. And I'm no offense to any Indianans listening, but I don't feel too terribly badly about that, because yeah. it was, my understanding, a pretty remote place in general, and I don't thrive in rural settings, I think.
I do more now than I used to. I mean, many of you know, I lived in New York City for 5 years or so, and I loved it. I still miss it, but I do kind of like the slower paced lifestyle now.
Yeah.
That isn't to say that I couldn't like immediately get back into living in the city. Like mm-hmm. I could definitely get back into it, but anyway, if you couldn't already tell, we're going to be doing something a little bit different this month, and we're going to be taking a deep dive into a TV show, and that TV show is indeed Eerie, Indiana. So we're going to do a full retrospective on the entire show. We're going to break this up into two episodes. So this month, we're going to talk about the first half of the show. Next month, we're going to talk about the second half. We might actually get into at least briefly mentioning the second series of Eerie, Indiana that came out, which I didn't even know about until
that was researching the show.
Yeah, like, the thing is, I loved this show as a kid. I was, like, obsessed with this show as a kid, and I had no idea. And apparently, the second series kicked off, like, right around the time when this one, like, was over. Like, it pretty much picked up right after this one. So just to give you some backstory, if you're not familiar with the show, it was created by Jose Rivera and Carl Schaefer. Joe Dante was a creative consultant on this, and it originally aired on NBC on September 15th, 1991 to April 12th, 1992. And it was,
and my research friend, in a Sunday night slot.
It was, yes, which is interesting. It was on Sunday nights at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. So
I don't
that's
know.
It's a very weird time.
I don't know when I thought the right time for Eerie, Indiana to be on was, but I don't think I would have guessed Sunday nights at 7:30.
I didn't know that for many years. I don't know. I think I was like looking up this show another time, like years ago. And I learned that it was originally like an evening show then, but I know the show, and probably most people from my generation know the show from being on the Fox Kids block on Fox on Saturday mornings. So later, Fox Kids picked it up, and it aired, it was like one of the last shows. So like, it's like all cartoons in the morning, and then like at the very end, the tail end of the block, they do like some live action stuff. And that's, I think, like probably when like Power Rangers was on, but like this show was on at the end, and it was extremely popular on Fox. And that's why they continued it with that new series, which I gotta say, like I haven't watched any of the new one yet, but it looks so far inferior to this one. Like, it doesn't even look like it's in the same caliber whatsoever as this one. So if you're not familiar with kind of what the show is about, It's about a 13-year-old kid named Marshall Teller, and he moves to this place called Erie, Indiana, from New Jersey with his family, his mom and his dad and his older sister. And he discovers that there's like some really weird stuff going on in this town. And the show is sort of just it's basically like a kid's version of X-Files, sort of.
Yeah.
You have Marshall, who's played by Omri Katz, and he is joined by his best friend Simon, played by Justin Shinkaro. And the two of them go on these, or have these like crazy, sometimes supernatural things that happen. And it usually involves some kind of like weird neighbor or something like that. But the thing that you notice right off the bat with this show is the production quality is much higher than something that you would typically see in a kid show. Like, I mean, it's shot on film, which I understand lots of shows were back then, but for today, it's very unusual to see a TV show shot on film.
Yeah.
And just the overall quality of like the acting, the writing, the directing, like everything on this show is of a much higher quality than something that really anything else you would see. The only thing that I would compare it to would be like Pete and Pete. Like I would say that Pete and Pete is up there in quality, but even I would say that this is even probably a higher quality than Pete and Pete, but I guess it makes sense considering it was originally developed for like a primetime slot.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably had a little bit of a bigger budget maybe than your typical
I would have to guess.
Show. So Ken, what's your familiarity with the show? We're going to go through the first 9 episodes or sorry, the first 10 episodes. Yeah, we're going to go through the first 10 episodes this month, but before we get into like the nitty-gritty of each one, what's your overall familiarity with the show? Were you did you know what it was? Have you seen it before?
I wasn't really familiar with it. I just knew it as one of those shows that lots of people remember and have very warm feelings towards. And I remembered at some point in the past, I don't know if it was on a podcast or offline, you had mentioned that you had brought up the show a couple of times. And so eventually I just thought, I discovered that it was on, you know, free with ads on YouTube. And so I suggested, let's talk about Erie, Indiana. Because it's always, I think, interesting to kind of break the usual format of the show and talk about something a little bit different. It was all from the outside for me going into this. I really didn't have any familiarity with it.
Okay. And I was, as I said, a pretty huge fan as a kid. So I think it aired on Fox in like 1997 or somewhere around there. And that was just kind of like the right age for me to be like really into this, because as a kid, I was into like horror movies and sci-fi and monster movies and stuff like that. So this was just like perfect for me, really. Getting into, I guess what we can do is just go down, start with the first episode. Now, we're going by the list on the YouTube playlist, which we discovered is not the actual air date. It uses the production date instead. So for the most part, it's it matches the air date, but there's like one, if I'm not mistaken, in there that's kind of thrown in that was actually the last episode to air. And I think that one, the weird thing about that one was that like it aired much later. So I think like the show got canceled, but they still had like one episode to put out there.
Mm.
So they dropped it. Like the last episode which was episode 18, aired on April 12th, 1992. But then the 19th episode didn't drop until December 9th, 1993.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was a huge gap in there.
It looks like from what I'm seeing, it might have just been like it just never aired on the network for whatever reason and just was unceremoniously thrown into the syndication package.
Yeah, I think because it went to, so after it left NBC, it went to the Disney Channel. And I think that in 93 is when it went to the Disney Channel. And that's when, during that run, is when the final episode aired. But interestingly, that final episode was actually the fifth to be shot. So the first episode it's called Foreverwhere. It's directed by Joe Dante. And one thing you'll notice is that Joe Dante directed a number of these, but then you also have like Bob Balaban.
Bob Balaban, yeah.
Yeah. Bob Balaban coming in, directing a bunch of them. So there was some, you know, there was some heft behind the camera here. And I think that's really evident. And I think that even if you're not super familiar with the show as we're talking about it, I think that you'll quickly understand that this is not like your typical kids show. It's not like the Goosebumps show or, you know, even Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's definitely more mature than something like that. So the show kicks off. I think it starts off pretty strong with Foreverwhere. The premise of this episode is that, and they do a really cool thing too, where they kind of set up the overarching story here. So a lot of this is like introducing Marshall and like him not being super happy about being in this like weird town and all of that stuff. But then you have the main story, and for the most part, these are all like self-contained stories. You have this, it's basically like a Tupperware lady who's like one of their neighbors, and she is trying to sell Marshall's mom on this like Tupperware stuff, which is called Foreverwhere. And Marshall discovers that there's some kind of like, it's like a little bit culty. There's something a little off about this whole situation. And then he discovers that after these really creepy twins that are the kids of this lady, they slip him a note, and it says like yearbook 1964 or something. So he goes and looks up the yearbook and realizes that those kids are in the yearbook from 1964. And through some snooping, he discovers that in the evening, the mom seals the kids in this Tupperware, and it prevents them from aging.
It turns out you can get Foreverwhere in people sized containers.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
it's
her husband was the inventor of this Foreverwhere. And first of all, like, I props to the props to the props team for making these giant containers.
Yeah, that's the reason that I was thinking about just like the concept of a people size Foreverwhere, because I thought that's just an amazing bit of prop work.
And it looks really good. Like, it looks like a legit Tupperware container. Yeah, I also like, there's like little details that they did with it too, where like the sons, the twins, like the mom seals them in so they can't get out. Like, once they're sealed in, that they're in there. But the mom has like a handle on hers because she seals herself in too to prevent herself from aging. And so you can see on hers, there's like a little handle that allows her to open her own container from the inside, which I thought was like a nice little touch. They went a little nuts with the dry ice in this, which is something that they do multiple times. They go a little bonkers with the dry ice, but
this seems like it was a dry ice heavy era.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it definitely was. It most certainly was. But I think that this episode does a good job of establishing just the overall vibe of the show, where it's a little bit lighthearted, but there's always something a little bit more serious happening beneath the surface. And I think that the themes of the show do kind of peek out in this pilot. And I think that it also just sets the groundwork for what's to come. And I think it's a really good episode to start the series off with.
Yeah, it definitely does well. And as you say, balancing that sincerely good at it does a good job at balancing the humor to it, because it is a show that takes great pleasure in just being ridiculous, but it's also just a show that's gently sinister from top to bottom. And I mean, in a nice way.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's some creepy, like, first of all, the twins are kind of inherently creepy. Like, they're designed to be weird. But then when you drill down a little bit and you think about how their mom is, like, keeping them in this perpetual state of childhood, and they're unable to grow up. And every year they're in like sixth grade or something. So they have to do sixth grade every year for like 30 years. And it's like, that's like a whole other level of, helicopter parenting, I think. And the way that it ends, I don't know. I guess we can just talk about how these end. I don't know.
I think this show carries a blanket spoiler warning in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way that it ends is I like the way that it ends as well, because you have so basically the mom, Marshall's mom, is like, she's a little bit brainwashed with the Foreverwear.
She's intrigued by it.
Yeah, she's not like completely sold on it, but at the same time, like, she's a very messy person, and she gets kind of wrapped up in the Foreverwear thing to become, cleaner, neater, all that stuff.
I do like the bit of business in both. I think showing how the series approaches itself, and from both the level of absurdity and the level of cluing us into what's going to follow, is she sold on Foreverwear because one of the sales pitches is that they get a Foreverwear tub that has a 17-year-old bologna sandwich in it that looks completely fresh as long as it's sealed, and they do some wonderful business throughout the episode with that, and I appreciated it very much.
When they finally showed it, because Marshall, he takes the lid off, and he doesn't put it back right.
No.
So later on, you see what happens.
All 17 of those years from 1974 to 1991 catch up with it all at once.
Yeah. What happens is the aging process is accelerated if you leave the tub off, the top. So Marshall and Simon rescue the twins, and the next thing they know, there's these like two 35-year-old men hammering in a for sale sign in the house, and it turns out that those are the twins, and the mom is seen in the window, and she's like, dust basically. So like I said, it was a good way to kick off the series, and I think it's a really good episode. This is one, it's interesting, I remember most of these episodes, and this is like the one that I remember the most for some reason. Like, this is the one that I can very easily remember, like, every little bit of it.
Is it possible that you might have seen this one first? Probably. As well?
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah.
I've probably seen this one a bunch of times. They probably reran it a million times. So that's episode one. Moving on to episode two, we have The Retainer. This is also written, this is also directed by Joe Dante. And this one is, I think when the show kind of starts to show its darker side and when it becomes apparent that this isn't just your regular old kid show, because there's two people that die in mm-hmm. this show, yeah, in this episode. I mean,
there's no death in the first episode, but there is, it is not trivial to future episodes.
Yeah, they, and that's, I think, something that is, like, definitely a, not something you see at all. I mean, even in, like, horror shows like Goosebumps and Are You Afraid of the Dark, I don't think, it's rare that you see people just straight up get killed, especially when it comes to kids. And mm-hmm. although they don't explicitly say that this kid dies in this, I think it's safe to assume that this kid dies, because they say they never see him again. And it's like, well, what could that mean? You never see the kid again.
Yes. Obviously.
And then also the retainer shows up at the end. So,
yeah. And it is made direct in future episodes when children are dying.
Yeah. And also there's a scene. So just to back up a little bit, the retainer, it's about this neighbor kid who gets this like giant retainer from this psychotic orthodontist guy, this really creepy guy who's got these like experimental retainers and stuff. And that's the other thing, is like you'll see that these like kind of these episodes are sort of revolve around like normal kid stuff mm-hmm. that as an adult, you're just like, oh, whatever. But as a kid, that is a horror show. Like mm-hmm. getting, I got a retainer when I was that age, and I was horrified. Like I didn't want a retainer. That's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the episodes you'll find deal with that type of stuff where they draw inspiration from real stuff that happens to you as a kid and kind of twist it around a little bit to make it into this kind of creepy story. So you have this neighbor kid, gets a retainer, and the retainer gives him the ability to hear dogs. So it, like, the metal in the retainer acts as sort of like a receiver, is tuned to the frequency of dog language. So he can hear everything that dogs are saying, and he uncovers this plot of like the dogs rising up and like just taking over, and he gets killed. Like mm-hmm. the dogs eat him. Mm. The dogs just straight up murder him. Again, we don't see it happen, but we do see the dogs like attack him, like all ganging up on him, and then he's gone. What we do see is there's a scene when they find out that the dogs are going to be breaking out all the other dogs that are in the pound. And so Marshall and Simon and this kid go to, I guess, see what's going on. And they literally find the dog catcher's femur. Like, they find his bones. Mm. So they, the dogs definitely kill the dog catcher.
Mm. I feel like it's also in the incredibly rare position for media aimed at children that the dogs are bad.
Yeah, and that is kind of a weird thing where, you know, usually if you're going to present an animal as bad, it's usually cats. Like mm-hmm. cats are usually the mean, the bad, the ones that are like plotting against you. But yeah, dogs are not. They're kind of the villains in this. There's also a scene when a dog attacks Simon, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's kind of interesting. Not really typical to see that, but the whole kind of the beginning of this is that Marshall discovers that he needs to get a retainer, and he's like not wanting to go because he's worried that this is going to happen to him too. But he ends up getting just a regular old retainer that doesn't allow him to communicate with dogs.
Hmm.
So this is another really great episode too, I think.
Yeah. I basically like all of these episodes so far.
Yeah, I think Yeah, I think just looking at all of them, I think they're all good. Like, I think it's a really great show. And there weren't any that, like, I mean, maybe there were some I liked more than others, but there weren't any that I, like, actively disliked. So I think The Retainers up there is, like, one of my favorites. So the next one is called The ATM with the Heart of Gold.
This is fascinating to me.
This one's directed by Sam Pillsbury. And this one's interesting because it involves, like, this AI that becomes sentient. And I feel like you didn't see a whole lot of that type of stuff. Obviously you did, like, you know, 2001 and all of those types of sci-fi movies, but you didn't see a ton of it by 1991. And so the premise of this one is that Marshall's dad works for this, like, I guess, tech company, and he develops this ATM that is run by this kind of Max Headroom looking AI, and Simon becomes friends with this program, and it starts giving him money, and all of a sudden Simon, he starts getting friends and he becomes popular, but it's all because of the money. And there's a couple aspects of this one that I think are really interesting beyond just the basic AI type thing. You find out that the money that Simon's getting is from other people's bank accounts, and he gives Simon so much money that everyone in the town goes bankrupt, which I think is kind of interesting. Which
is interesting because he did not, because we sh- it, it, I mean, the episode is about Simon spending a lot of money, but he did not spend that much money. So unless people in this town don't have any money, which it doesn't seem to be the case because it's just presented as this very kind of middle class,
yeah,
town, or we miss the part where he buys, like, he buys a bunch of houses. Yeah, yeah. He just buys an entire street of houses.
Yeah, he has, like, so much money, and he does return it at the end. But I think that one of the kind of more interesting things that this episode starts to explore is Simon's home life and how he clearly does not have a good situation at home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that he's just, like, he is poor, but it's not just that. It's that his parents seem to be in some sort of, like, divorce type thing, where there's a scene when Marshall is over there, over at Simon's, and you can hear a woman laughing, and Marshall's like, "Oh, your mom's really laughing at something, isn't she?" And Simon says, "My mom's not home." And I feel like that scene is actually pretty powerful because it doesn't explicitly spell out what's happening, but it seems very clear that he's kind of going through some not great stuff with his parents.
It's a show that's definitely giving that character more to do and more to be than you would suspect a lot of shows kind of set up along the same lines would.
Yeah, he's definitely more than a sidekick. And I mean, this episode, I think, is a good example of, I mean, it's only the third episode in the series, and it's completely centered on him. And I think later on, they do more with developing Simon as a character and his kind of tumultuous home life and that type of stuff. But a lot of it is just, like, small hints, like him wanting to stay over at Marshall's house for dinner and stuff like that. And it's like, there's just these small things. that I bet most kids watching the show wouldn't even pick up on. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of adults who are watching it can either relate to a lot of the situations that are presented in the show, or, you know, can at least pick up on some of the subtle things that they include in some of these episodes. And there's more to it than just this one specifically that we'll probably get into.
You feel bad. I mean, you want Simon to have nice things. You understand, but he can't have nice things because even when he gets nice things, it turns out it's from a malicious ATM that's bankrupting the entire town.
Yeah.
Oh, Simon cannot catch a break.
No, he can't. Poor Simon. He just wanted a friend with Mr. Wilson. See, the whole thing was here that Simon is only 10 and Marshall's 13. And Marshall is like, the two of them became friends early on, but now Marshall is starting to try to hang out with kids his age. And, you know, when you're that age, like every year is so drastic as far as like development. So like, it makes sense that Marshall would want to hang out with, you know, these kids who are his age, like 13 years old, because to him, Simon is still like a little kid, you know, wanting to play with action figures and stuff. So Simon feels abandoned by both his best friend and likely his parents. So he, you know, becomes best friends with an ATM, naturally.
I mean,
but it's also funny because there's a scene when Marshall's dad, again, he created this whole thing, and he's like going through the reports, and he's like, huh. He's like, there's only one person using Mr. Wilson, but he's using it a lot. And then, like, there's another time when he's, like, going through and he's like, man, Mr. Wilson did $4 million in transactions. And it's like, I feel like you have too much information here, buddy. Like,
yeah.
You're not the bank. You're just a guy who created this, like, AI.
Yeah. It's very, yeah. Well, first of all, just the idea that, of course, the ATM would interact in a human context to feel like it was emulating human connection, which turned out to be very critical for how the episode ends up going, to act as a friend. And secondly, yeah, that was bizarre. That was very much like, we need to introduce this exposition now so we can set up the...
But also, the fact that he's like, okay, well, let's set aside the fact that, like, it's weird that he has all this information. One person? Simon is literally the only person using the ATM. Like, as far as I can tell, it's the only bank in this town. So what are these people doing? They're going old school and, like, filling out a withdrawal slip and going into the bank? Is that what we're led to believe?
Yeah,
not a single other person is using this Mr. Wilson thing, because they took one look at it and they're like, that is really creepy, and I don't want to be talking to some AI when I just want to get 20 bucks out for lunch.
Yeah, this is there's a lot of questions about that. This feels like a bizarre thing to say. I am beginning to question the general infrastructure of Erie, Indiana.
Well, I mean, we know it's a weird place. We know that logic doesn't really have a place in Erie, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
They do say we see that Elvis lives there, Sasquatch lives there. There's that weird lady with the straight jacket. Don't know what that's all about.
And Elvis is not just a cameo in the opening credits.
No, yeah,
Elvis
he's in there.
Features in the story.
Yeah. He's in there. The straitjacket lady, you see her later too, like in the background. And that's the other thing, quickly. If you pay attention, you see all kinds of weird stuff. Mm-hmm. Like background characters, they'll just give them like weird stuff to do. Like the one episode, I think it was the letter, the one with Tobey Maguire. Mm-hmm. You see a person walking in the background with
the wire in the show.
Yeah, you see somebody walking with a giant scythe in the background. for like no reason. But you were saying.
Yeah, no, I did want to point out. There were some interesting directors on this show, Joe Dante and Bob Balaban, as we were saying. But I wasn't familiar with Sam Pillsbury, so I looked him up, and I found out that he doesn't make films anymore. He's a winemaker now, because I found, when I Googled him, one of the first things I found was an interview with him on this wine website, and I just feel like I need to add. It was an email interview, so the writer emailed these questions to him, and he emailed them back, his answers back, in all caps, and it was reproduced in all caps. So it's just, regular, prose case or whatever the term is, questions, and then he just yelling all caps answers with like 5 exclamation points. That's what I know about Sam Pillsbury.
Did they ask him about Erie, Indiana?
I do not believe it. I did not look closely enough. I all the all caps and all the typing, it wore me out. I'd have to look at it again. Probably did it.
Even if I was interviewing him about wine, I couldn't not.
Yeah.
Interview him about
director about of two Erie, episodes Indiana. Of Erie, Indiana. Here.
Yeah, I want to know more. I mean, he did Free Willy 3, The Rescue, too. I mean, I guess you could ask him about that, but really, who cares about Free Willy 3? I'm here to talk about Erie, Indiana.
The AI ATM.
Yeah, I need to know more about this. So, yeah, that's episode 3. That's another solid episode. Moving on to episode 4, we have The Losers. This is also written, how do I keep saying written? This is also directed by Joe Dante. This one is, it's kind of interesting. I feel like that this is a little bit of a lesser one.
It's a good concept, but it doesn't really.
Yeah, it's a good concept. It's one of the more goofy ones that is pretty much just like a straight up kind of comedy. The one thing that I did like with this one was the production design. It felt very, the place that he goes, like the Bureau of the Lost or whatever it's called, feels very kind of like Gilliam-esque in its design, where it feels very dark and dirty and cluttered, but it also this like little twinge of like kind of sci-fi, where there's like tubes and machines everywhere and wires and stuff. So what you have here is Marshall discovers that his dad lost his briefcase that has this like really important prototype thing for his work, and he's afraid that he's going to get fired. And he also just figures out that there's like kind of something weird happening where people are like just losing stuff at a accelerated pace. So him and Simon try to like set up these traps, and what he does is they decide like, okay, what do people lose a lot? And the answer is luggage. And so Marshall decides to hide himself in a trunk and get lost, quote unquote. And he ends up in this like secret underground, like the Bureau of the Lost, which is like this kind of bureaucratic organization that takes stuff so that people can buy more stuff. So like, I guess it's like this kind of statement on capitalism.
I think that's a good reading. I could also see people wanted to, I don't know, read it as complaining about big government or something, that there's a department dedicated to losing things.
yeah.
There's so many readings.
I think the whole like bureaucracy of that does play a part, but the fact that he says like that they exist just so that the wheels of capitalism can keep turning, basically, and that people continue to consume and spend money. He's like, well, what if I didn't take his briefcase? Then he'd have that briefcase for many years. You know, he wouldn't be able to buy a new one if I didn't take this one.
It's
a fun episode. Yeah, I think
it's a very interesting reading on planned obsolescence, almost as an allegory.
It really is. Yeah. And you have, his name is escaping me right now. It's the guy from, it's the Klopek from The Burbs, one of my all-time favorite movies ever. And he plays like the head guy. And, you know, it's fine. I don't really have much to say about this one.
I like the production design of the Department of the Lost.
There's definitely some fun stuff in this one. So next is America's Scariest Home Video. I liked this one quite a bit just because it reminded me of Halloween as a kid. I mean, this one is a Halloween episode. It takes place on Halloween. And Simon and Marshall are all excited about going trick-or-treating, and then they realize that Marshall's mom had to, like, do something at work, or I can't remember what the reason was, but she had to leave. And she had she told Marshall and Simon that they needed to watch or babysit Simon's little brother. So they can't go trick-or-treating. They got to stay home, give out candy, watch the little brother. They go in to make some popcorn in the kitchen, and they're watching, they have a scary movie on the TV, and Marshall sets up his camcorder to record the movie off TV, which right there, anybody who is of a younger generation will not understand that whole concept, that the way that you used to be able to record shows off TV was to connect your camcorder to the TV and then hit record, because those camcorders recorded directly to VHS tapes, which is something that I have done in the past, which is just, it's wild that that's how we used to do things. So they're recording this movie. It's a mummy movie, and the kid bites down on the remote for the TV, and it causes this like weird chain reaction where the camera goes nuts and it ends up sucking the kid into the movie. And the mummy that was in the movie gets, it's a swaparoo. And the mummy ends up in the real world. And Marshall and Simon have to get him swapped back. I don't know if this was something that was explored in TV or movies. I mean, I know that in Willy Wonka we see that with the TV kid, but I don't know if it was really explored before. Since then, we've seen it a lot. I feel like a lot of TV and movies kind of play with this concept of being transported into a TV show or a movie. I mean, Last Action Hero did it. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like it wasn't a very common trope or idea in 1991. So it felt kind of different. And yeah, I thought it was fun.
Yeah. There are some of these episodes where it feels like there's a lot to talk about piece by piece, and I think there's still a couple more left in this first half that definitely fit that. Then there are other ones where it's like, yeah, it's fine. There's no episode here that's anything less than at least fine.
Yeah, it's not like this one had a lot of deep meanings or anything. You could probably, you know, pull some kind of meaning from it about like TV or something, but for the most part, it was just a fun little Halloween story.
Nothing wrong with that.
One of the things that I liked is that they think that it's the mummy that gets transported. So they're all scared. They're like, oh, there's a mummy on the loose. It's going to kill everybody. But it's not a mummy. It's the actor who plays the mummy. So it turns out that it's just a dude who gets transported, which I think is kind of a fun little twist.
Yeah, it's
on
the
it.
Difference between like a comparatively, you know, well-worn trope for a horror story and the eerie Indiana version of it.
Yeah, exactly. So I enjoyed this one. It was pretty fun. Like way overuse of the dry ice in this one. This one was nuts. The whole house was like covered in dry ice. It was insane. Also, this one featured a pretty like a makeout scene with Marshall's parents, which I thought was kind of interesting, and just another element that you would never see in any other like Saturday morning kids show.
That's because it's a Sunday night primetime show.
Right. Next up, we have Just Say No to Fun. Now, this one was not included in on the YouTube playlist.
Yeah, it goes from 5 to 7.
Yeah, which is weird. I don't know why this one's not included.
I was initially worried it was going to be some sort of weird rights thing, so it wasn't going to be anywhere, but then... I think we almost realized at the exact same time. You sent me the link a couple seconds before I almost landed on that exact same page. It's on Amazon, also streaming, yeah, and it's there. It's perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's free on it. Yeah. It's free with commercials on Amazon, so you can just watch it on there. I don't know why it's not included. It's weird. The playlist is in the right order too. Like it literally just skips from 5 to 7. So I don't know. So this one is about there's an eye exam at school. And of course this is another one of these things that like it's drawing from stuff that kids have to go through. It would be kind of funny if instead of the eye exam, it was like a lice check. Like you had to go in to get checked for lice. And that's what it, that they put in something in their head that controlled them or something. But what they have here is an eye exam, and it's like a crazy nurse who basically brainwashes the kids into being like these kind of zombie kids.
Yeah.
Like, you know, perfectly well-behaved children with no personalities.
Yeah, this one seems like it's a little more along the lines of like a traditional kids show in terms of setting up the conflict and what the antagonist's goal is, because in contrast to some of the other episodes that are a little bit more abstract about it, she just says her goal is to make people not have fun.
Yeah.
That is her job.
and it's also, it definitely fits the whole kind of kids rule, parents suck. Like grown-ups suck. Like that whole kind of attitude you had in the 90s where there was this like major rally against like adults and authority and that type of stuff. And like I remember there were like so many stories like this, like books and stuff. Like I remember there was like my teacher is an alien and my teacher is a monster and stuff like that. Just a lot of books and movies and media properties that kind of played with the idea of adults being, having ulterior motives and being kind of more malicious than what they set out to be.
And if,
I did. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, and that belief and that for a kid that gets contrasted and turned even more anxiety inducing during that harrowing time as a child when you see one of your teachers out in public. It's a very disorienting experience. But the teachers don't want to see you either.
I think that you could also look at this just on a level of like just having to get glasses in school. Mm-hmm. Like that whole experience, because I mean, maybe it's different now, but when I was a kid, if you got glasses, you were a nerd. Like that's it. Like all of a sudden, and it's sort of like how it's like a perception thing where when I got glasses, I was concerned that people were going to be like calling me a nerd and stuff like that. And that I was going to be perceived as one of these like, you know, goody goody kids that are represented in this episode, because they all get glasses. And as soon as they get the glasses, then they turn into the like, you know, zombie teacher's pets. So I think that is a factor with this episode as well. good episode overall. I liked the there's a little bit of like stop motion going on with this one with the eye tester thing, and I thought that was kind of cool.
It's an interesting effect. Sort of reminded me of, I would be remiss not to mention this, the opening title sequence to the show.
Oh yeah, yeah, yep.
I just want to make sure that I pointed it out.
It's a good opening title sequence.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so that is Just Say No to Fun. Basically what happens is Marshall, of course, Simon goes in and he gets the brainwashing. Marshall immediately knows something weird is going on. And then he, with the aid of, so there's this like, what's it called? Like the store that they hang out in. There's this like store. It's called like the World of Stuff or something like that, where it's a kid's hangout spot that they have like,
I can't quite remember
candy.
The name, yeah. The flat place.
It's called like the World. Yeah. I think it's called the World of Stuff, but like they have like candy and like arcade machines. And it's a hangout spot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they sell all kinds of like weird toys and like joke stuff and magic tricks and all that stuff. And so Marshall talks to the owner of that place and they go through this like sequence of like, it's like breaking out the ultimate like joke item. And it turns out to be like a pair of Groucho glasses with the, you know, the nose and the mustache. And what they called it like the GM 20 or something like that, which I thought was kind of funny.
Yeah.
And that's what broke the brainwashing when Marshall put that on and Simon saw it.
It was behind a break glass in case of emergency shield.
Yeah, it did introduce the fact that Simon cannot fake laugh at all. Like the laughing that actor did was horrible. But either way, that's basically what happens. Marshall deprogrammed Simon, but then he gets reprogrammed and almost derails the whole plan, but then they pull it together in the end and save everybody. It's funny how like these two kids like are just constantly saving the town and people's lives, and like they get like no recognition for it. Like even after all of this, you know, we're already six adventures into this, and like nobody recognizes them. Yeah, nobody recognizes them as like heroes. The next one is Heart on a Chain. This one is also directed by Joe Dante. This one is kind of interesting because it deals with death.
Yes.
This is definitely not a topic that gets discussed very much in kid shows.
You know, mortality sort of obviously has to linger over all of Erie, Indiana, but this is an episode that deals with it more directly as a matter of fact for what the episode's about.
Yeah, and I think props to them for going there with it. I think that this is a very interesting episode. You have this new kid who starts. Marshall becomes friends with him. His name's Devin. And he's like this really cool, really cool, cool dude. And then you have this new girl who starts named Melanie, played by Danielle Harris. And both Devin and Marshall kind of like fall for this girl. But it turns out that she needs a heart transplant. She's ill. Her heart is failing. Devin, who's this like cool skater dude, gets in a horrific accident. He gets hit by a truck and dies. Mm-hmm. And the heart, I guess he was an organ donor. His heart is given to the Melanie, and she gets Devin's heart. And as a result, her personality starts to change and she sort of like starts acting like Devin. Mm. And it's just it's a really interesting episode. I found this one to be very interesting. Just on a kid show level. Like the fact that they, it's not like it's a gruesome, no, like, even though it says in the description he dies in a gruesome accident. I don't know. Like, it's not, I wouldn't say that that's gruesome necessarily, but
yeah. I mean, is there a non-gruesome way to get run over by a truck?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, they don't show. No. They don't really. They don't show anything. But it is. Yeah, it's just kind of interesting because Marshall is. You know, he likes Melanie. He's upset. He's very sad, that he lost his friend Devin. Melanie's sad too because it was like it was a love triangle situation. And every time Marshall starts to get close, Devin sort of gets involved and, like, I don't know what he does, squeezes her heart or something, like makes her heart stop.
It's actually pretty concerning.
Yeah. And it's like, because at first I'm like, what's he going to do? He's going to do this for, like, every relationship she gets in for the rest of her life. He's going to just stop her heart. Like, that's pretty brutal.
This is actually, in a strange way, a interesting, I don't know, mirror image, for lack of a better term, of an episode that we'll be discussing shortly in theme and content.
Very much, yeah. You never really know. You never really know for sure that it's actually Devin. I mean, you don't see, like, his ghost doing anything or anything like that. Yeah, I think it's very heavily implied, and especially at the end when they show the tombstone with the little angel that cries, which felt weird to me, like felt a little bit out of place. Like, I don't know why it would be crying when it seemed like a pretty happy, like, conclusion, but whatever. Mm. So, yeah, that one, definitely one of the heavier episodes.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it's, more child death. It's interesting. There are different ways that the show approaches kind of that twist into the surreal or the supernatural. But all of them, I think, what makes the show good is that it has 24 minutes an episode, but it always has this very precise way of just, like, taking it and just periodically turning it a little bit more into the surreal and the supernatural and the sinister, by just starting from that, like, even-handed, like, you know, point to take people and to take target audience in, and then just slowly turning the dial. And I think there's something interesting about how it's still maintaining that structure, but it's coming at it in different ways episode to episode.
Yeah, I think you make a good point here, and also they do that a lot where they give you the basic premise and then they twist it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So, like, when you're watching this episode, the part when Devin gets killed and you find out that Melanie gets his heart, it feels like it's the end. Like, it makes you feel like that's the twist. Like, oh, mm-hmm. you know, Melanie got his heart, but then it keeps going and then it gets into the whole, like, her attitude changes and she starts acting like Devin. And it's like this whole other layer that gets added on top. Mm-hmm. And they do that a lot with this show where they'll add additional pieces in even after you think, like, okay, it's over, which is, I think, kind of definitely an interesting element to the show. Moving on. We have the dead letter, and this one is essentially, it is kind of the same as Heart on a Chain. This is the one with Tobey Maguire, and the premise of this one is that Marshall finds this old letter, and upon finding the letter, it releases the ghost of this 13-year-old boy, played by Tobey Maguire. And this boy was hit by a car and killed, and he wasn't able to, he was meeting up with, I guess, who he considered to be like the love of his life, and he wasn't able to deliver this letter, so he's been, you know, stuck as a ghost ever since then. And Simon and Marshall have to deliver the letter, or else Tobey Maguire continues to haunt them. Yes. Which, one of the weird things about this one is that he's haunting them, sort of, but he, like, casts a spell on Marshall's family where they, like, they, like, love him, which is really weird.
Yeah, there's a... It doesn't feel entirely necessary to where this ends up going.
No. It's just very strange to add that. This one's directed by Tim Hunter, by the way. I thought that this episode was fine. It didn't really feel like it was treading on new enough ground for me. Like, I don't know. I just was, like, not very impressed with this one. This is another episode that I remember just because of the Tobey Maguire thing. I don't know.
I mean, it's very much, especially seeing these episodes so close together, it's very much we've been here. We've been in this territory very recently.
And I mean, the previous episode was a very similar story, and the thing is, like, I think that episode did it way better. Like, I thought that was a far more compelling story than the dead letter, where you have Tobey Maguire's Trip McConnell, a 13-year-old kid that gets hit by a car in the 20s.
Yeah, 1929. Spends the next 62 years waiting for someone to deliver his letter for him.
But also the stakes feel significantly lower in this one, and because all they have to do is deliver a letter. Like, it seems like at first there's a little bit of pushback because the lady doesn't believe them, but it's like, you just got to deliver the letter, dude. Like, that's, I mean, it's just feels like there needed to be some sort of heightened conflict in this one.
Yeah, it does make you wonder if all the other stuff that was thrown into it was just to kind of let the episode spin its wheels a bit.
I think it was, because I'm certain that that's what it was. This one just, again, it was fine. Like, it was still entertaining, but I think that this was just definitely a lesser one compared to the others that we previously discussed. And I think it was also, this is also the second episode that involved a possible love interest for Marshall. He did make out with Danielle Harris in that episode. Again, not something that you typically see in kid shows. And then in this one, the niece of the lady, it seemed like there was a kind of, something going on there. Some sparks.
Well, as you said, it feels like a kid show that is definitely aimed at a slightly older audience than other kid shows.
I did read, now, there are some other episodes that I remember, like, very vividly, that happened later on in the series. However, I did read here on the Wikipedia that for the later episodes, NBC was trying to have them make it more adult and appeal more towards adults. So I'll be curious to see, like, what happens in the later episodes. The
second half.
I know that there's a character that they add, like a regular character later on, who I think that they were trying to appeal to more adults, but I don't know if it worked. But yeah, we'll get to those later. The next one that we're going to be talking about is The Lost Hour. This one's quite a good one. Basically, this is kind of like a time. I like anything that kind of messes around with time. And this one does something that's kind of cool. Like, I've never seen this. It doesn't make sense, but I haven't seen this before in anything else. Basically, it's daylight savings time. Indiana doesn't observe daylight savings time. I didn't look this up. I was going to look it up.
I don't know
if
that's true.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true or not, but according to the show, Indiana doesn't observe daylight savings time, and Marshall gets a little pissy about it and decides that he's going
to... It's such a weird thing to get upset about.
I know. He's going to turn his watch back anyway, as if that's going to do anything, but actually it does do something. It ends up transporting him an hour into the past in a different dimension. So he ends up getting sucked into this like alternate reality where there's like no people in there except for other people who happen to go into this dimension. And it turns out that there's been this missing girl. They think that she's a runaway. She's been missing for an entire year. And it turns out that she's also in this like kind of dimension that's an hour behind everyone else. So
I was struggling a little bit with the logic of all of this, like yeah. trying to figure out exactly what it meant to be an hour behind.
The fact that he's an hour behind and like no one else is there.
It's like, so people just don't exist before.
But they do say that it's a different dimension too.
Yeah.
So
what they really meant is they just plunged him into a different universe.
Yeah. But there's also still a connection to the present because he ends up meeting this milkman who, when you look in the back of the milkman's truck, mm-hmm. it like transports you onto the milk carton, like as a lost kid, which is, this one is definitely out there. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you have this group of garbage men, sort of, that go around and find items that should not be in that timeline and destroy them in order to preserve like the space-time continuum. And so when they find out that Marshall is in this like alternate reality or whatever, this past, they go after him and they're trying to kill him. And he ends up finding the girl and he works with the milkman to get them back. And the way that they get him back is that they have Simon. He talks to Simon through the milk carton and has Simon set his watch back, or no, forward an hour? Yeah, forward an hour, which like triggers this thing that spits him back out into the present. It's a pretty goofy episode.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's one of those where I feel like the concept is pretty strong, but it maybe falls apart even a little faster than the other ones for which I felt that way.
Yeah, yeah.
This
one is directed by Bob Balaban. It's written by Vance DeGeneres, Ellen's brother.
Mm.
And it the missing girl is played by Nikki Cox. So
I've done some research on Indiana and daylight saving time. If you're wondering,
I am wondering.
It was observed in parts of, if for some reason the state was, or maybe still is, split between central and eastern time, and parts of the state had it and parts of it didn't have DST, and then it was not adopted statewide until 2006.
Ah, okay. So in 1991, it would seem that they,
yeah,
at least where they were not observing it. Although the dad says it's the whole state, so he's wrong, loser. Yeah.
Well, they're new to the state. They don't know.
Yeah, he doesn't know. Yeah. Also, he's got like all kinds of weird inventions.
Yeah, there's a lot going on for him. I guess he's not researching this.
So, what did you think of this episode? Did you like this one?
Like I said, I liked...
Sorry. Go ahead. There's another huge thing that happens in this, but...
No. I was just saying, I liked the concept, but I don't think it exactly worked out in a way that I felt was as strong. It's just one of those where they're always giving interesting concepts, but sometimes they just can't budget it succinctly in 24 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, like, there just wasn't anything really consequential with this one. Like, yeah. There just wasn't really anything that compelling going on. There was the whole angle with the missing girl, I think, was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that's saying. But one of the weird things about this one is that at the end, Marshall finds out that the milkman that's been helping him is him in 90 years. So he finds out that this guy who's been helping him is the 103-year-old version of himself. And the reason for that is completely unknown. Like, there's no, like, it makes no sense, like, why he's there. I don't get that at all.
Hmm.
I don't know what Bob Balaban was getting at with that, or Vance DeGeneres, but very strange that
again in that feeling that there are these great ideas that just get peppered through these episodes, but I just think that the time and the format don't always allow for it.
Yeah, maybe there was something more there, or maybe they were gonna revisit that later or something. I don't know. Who knows? Might have been something really deep that we just completely missed. The final episode that we're going to be talking about this month was The Broken Record. This is directed by Todd Holland. This was the last episode. And I think that this one is quite good too. This is another one that I think is dealing with topics that are not seen very much. It's dealing with topics very head on too. Mm-hmm. That are just not seen very much in this format.
Yeah, if there's also the sliding scale for Erie, Indiana, between abstract messaging and more direct messaging, this one is on the very direct end of it.
Yeah, yeah. What you have here is this kid named Todd, who is a friend of Marshall and Simon's. He's like a kind of nerdy kid. He's not very popular. He's very soft spoken. And they are hanging out with him one day, and they're in like a music shop, and they find this band that they really like called, I keep wanting to say Butthole Surfers, because that's clearly who it's in reference to.
What are they calling them?
It's something surfers.
Yeah, and it sort of feels like an off rhyme.
Yeah, it's definitely, shoot, I cannot remember the name of the band.
Maybe it's there.
But yeah, basically like Butthole Surfers. And they play the record. This kid Todd, not familiar with the band, he doesn't know anything about it. They go to his house, play the record for him, and it's like a revelation for this kid. It is like a whole new world has opened up for him. Pitbull Surfers. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Definitely a play on Butthole Surfers there. But he immediately relates to the lyrics. And by the way, the music's horrible. Like,
yeah, that
the
Pitbull feels like
Surfers are horrible.
That's a terrific small detail for this episode.
This is a terrible
band.
This was shot in 1991, and the music that they're listening to is like the most generic like 80s hair metal band. It's so bad. But this kid is just in love, and his dad ends up like busting in and being verbally abusive, frankly, to the son. Calling him like stupid and stuff like that in front of his friends, no less. And of course, Simon and Marshall are like, okay, we're we're gonna go ahead and leave and we're gonna go home. And then like the next day, Todd shows up to their little hangout and he's like all punked out. Like he looks like he's a completely different person.
Literally. Overnight.
Yeah. And he's still like having constant problems with his dad. Things are escalating. His dad's becoming more verbally abusive. Doesn't like outright hit him or anything, but like you can kind of see that like things are heading that direction. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe that would have been going a little too far on for the show, but it seems like they were getting as close to that as they could. And it turned out that like it was one of those situations where like you play the record backwards and like, you know, there's like satanic messaging or whatever that dumb rumor was during the satanic panic. And the twist here is that when you play the record backwards, it is literally his dad saying the exact things about the music that he was saying when he was being verbally abusive before. Which is a pretty cool twist, I think.
Yeah. I think it's sort of the opposite of what I'd been describing earlier, where there was a lot of build up to something that didn't really work. I think the payoff here works, but there's not a lot of build up to it. But I mean, like I said, every episode on this, there's no bad episode of this I've seen.
No, there's not.
I just think it's a show that's struggling with the number of places it can go with its ideas within the time frame, and that manifests itself in different ways sometimes when it does have trouble.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, there's certain limitations that they were working within. I think that it's a very fine line that they were trying to balance on. It's a weird show, like tonally, because it's somewhere in between being like just a straight up kid show and being for like young adults. And so, and also I think that they were kind of hamstrung by the format, you know, like some of these stories, I would argue that The Broken Record is one that could have had, you know, 45 minutes of content and had that, you know, that climax be developed a little bit more and explored a little bit deeper than just them simply playing it and then seeing the dad like basically have a mental breakdown over it. Because The Broken Record is a very heavy episode when you think about it, because this guy is so horrible. And then at the end, Marshall, who, by the way, he narrates all the episodes, which I don't really have a problem with because it's usually at the beginning and at the end. And like the narration's not too bad. That's normally something that bothers me, more specifically in movies, but TV shows, it also bothers me. Not so much in this one.
No.
Because I think it's fine here. I think that there's also like a kind of a wraparound thing here where like he's writing like a journal and like keeping evidence of all of the weirdness and stuff. So it makes sense narratively speaking as well. But anyway, at the end of this one, when the dad discovers that like he was the one being manipulated, Marshall says that he feels bad for the dad too. And I thought that was like a pretty poignant moment in the show, or in this episode specifically. So yeah, it's a pretty great show. I think it's like definitely something unique, and I think that it is absolutely worth checking out. I'm excited to check out the second half. And I'm not excited, but I'm a little bit curious to see what Fox did with that other series. I can't even remember. It's called Erie, Indiana, like, and then there's a subtitle like The Other Dimension.
The Other Dimension. Yeah.
Erie, Indiana, The Other Dimension.
It's 15 episodes of it.
Yeah, I mean, we're likely not gonna watch them all, Because I have a strong feeling that it's going to suck. If it's good, yeah. If it's good, I'll watch more. But something tells me that they're not going to understand what made the original series different and good. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be like a Goosebumps ripoff or something like that.
Mm.
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for that.
Yeah. I'm excited to see where the rest of the show goes.
Anything else you want to add about this first half before we close it out?
I like it so far.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
And also let us know if you like these types of episodes, because we can definitely do this again. There are other shows that I would like to do like more kind of retrospective episodes on. So,
mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, it's always fun to try something.
Yeah. I mean, like doing movies is fun, but I also like to deviate from that as well. And mm-hmm. talk about some of these, lesser known TV shows and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the Sofia Coppola one. I had an absolute blast diving into that.
That was a really fun episode.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this month. Thank you so much for listening. You can send us your 90s topics to 90s@filmpulse.net or by sending us a DM on Twitter or Facebook at 90s pod. If you could also consider reviewing us on iTunes, that would be very helpful. Until next month, for Ken Bakley, my name's Adam Patterson, and this has been Saved by the 90s.
Bye, everyone.